I'd like this session to be a lot more questions from you, but I'd like to say three basic things. The point I'd like to make is, first I wrote every man in mission, and then I realized that that was a sexist statement, so I said every person in mission.
You want to start questioning that one?
I think there are three things that I see existing in the conception of mission, I think, as it ought to be. And whenever I say as it ought to be, I realize we're always talking proximately or penultimately. I think what's happening today is good. But probably 50 years from now, they'll say, well, that old fogey Herb Zorn didn't know what he was talking about, which is probably true. But the first and most important fact is to get straight in our minds that the mission is God's mission, that God is carrying it out. And I admit that I use this text probably not completely contextually, but I love it. It's the statement of Mordecai to Esther. You remember Esther has, Mordecai has found out that Haman has the Jews under the extermination order. And he sends a note in to Esther and says, you've got to go before the king and get this thing changed some way or another. And Esther says, I can't do that, because you know that there is the law that if anyone goes before the king and is not received without invitation and is not received by the king, that person is killed. I could get killed in this thing. And then Mordecai makes some very fine, pious statements that everybody's going to pray about this. And then he says to her, perhaps you have been born for a time like this, but know this, salvation will come from Israel from some point or other. That's not my doubt. Perhaps you, Esther, have been born for a time like this. But those two things being put together, the mission of saving Israel is God's mission. He's going to take care of it. But Esther, I think you're the person that he's fingered for it. But that doesn't mean that if you don't do it, Israel isn't going to be saved. And that concept of mission, that God is out in the world. You know, when people say someone has been brought to Jesus Christ, I get more and more nervous about that, because it just seems to me that at best we can say you can introduce a person to Jesus Christ who's been there long before I have been there. That idea is so extremely important. The mission is God's, and to get that into one of its most practical aspects, in my later years in India, I used to play tennis, doubles tennis, I assure you, starting about 4:30 or 5 in the evening. And my tennis partners or opponents were almost invariably Hindus and Muslims and a few Christians from the Syrian Christian community. And after the tennis match was over, we would sit there and get our breath, or some others were playing, and then I tried to get a conversation started. And you know, I didn't go, are you saved? That would have killed everything. But try to get things moving, and that it was almost impossible. These were almost all very highly educated people, people who knew the Bible so well. One day Dorothy was playing ping pong with a girl, a Hindu girl, and another one came up and said, would you like to play another? And what'd she say?
She said, sufficient unto the day is the evil thereof.
Quoting the Bible, because she'd been through a Catholic or a Christian school, but absolutely, completely out of context. And after, I came home one day and I said to Martin Kretzmann, Mick Kretzmann, who's going to be here in February, you must all come back for that. Martin Kretzmann, I said to him, you know, I just simply can't get things started. How do you really get through Witness Christ? And he said, Herb, do you really think that God started working only when you and I came around here? Do you realize that God is working among these people at every time? And when I said, how? He said, I don't know either, but God is working. That confidence. That's the first one. The second one is that the activity of God is as great outside of our own bailiwick as it is among ourselves. Now, when I suppose that's a danger of Holden Village. When we come together and have this tremendous interplay of spiritual activity, we say, and we say rightly, the Spirit of God is really here. But does that mean, are we trying to say something else by that? The Spirit of God is not really there when you're on an assembly line or you're in the drudgery of teaching that course, the course roughly 2 weeks before graduation, and the only question is whether you or the students are more anxious for the school year to end. Isn't the Spirit of God working there? And again, I think we've got to see that in completely different societies, the Spirit of God is working, and the knowledge that these people have, knowledge in the sense of having gone through Luther's catechism and understanding all 66 books of the Bible, important as it is, has not controlled the power of the Spirit of God. And the third thing, and that's the one perhaps where it's hardest, and that is the tremendous respect we have to have for the church, and I'm not speaking in an organized sense, the church, the presence of the people of God in other parts of the world. That when we see other people worshiping God and dedicated to Jesus Christ in completely different contexts, that we have to have a tremendous respect for this and to go among people like that and say, I really want to know what you are saying by that. Instead of coming to them and saying, well, I have come out of a Christian communion which really goes right back to Luther's Reformation and I can tell you a great number of things. Those three things, God's initiative in all mission, secondly, that things are happening among other people fully as potently, I guess is the word I want to use, as they're happening among us. And thirdly, that as we see other people, we have to respect the church right where it is. Now that flies in the face of the sort of thing, I'm afraid, that took us out to India in 1947. I was quite convinced that I was probably a knight in white shining armor there to bring the gospel to the many poor and ignorant heathen. And if I wouldn't go, the souls were probably ticking off into eternal damnation, dropping off into eternal damnation, 10 to every tick of the clock. And therefore, that impulse lay upon me. I had to go. And that's law, that's not gospel. Secondly, I simply, at that time, I really didn't think of the difference between being a Missouri Synod Lutheran missionary who would carry a certain tradition over to India with me and being a person who would witness to Christ in other parts of the world. To my mind, if I could translate it into the Malayalam language, I had it down cold. And for that, we're talking about that little book, Silent Language. Language is such a tremendous thing, far beyond vocabulary. And the third thing was a real respect for the church. The words that we used to use, my congregations, my mission work, those are my pastors there who are working under me. We used to toss those words off as though they didn't, you know, that's the way you did it. After all, that's where we came from. Now today I think that any person who is going into a foreign field, and I want to say that's just as true over here, we have to understand God's power, the way God is working among other people, and this tremendous respect, so that we are the servants of God through any church to which we would come as a guest, or to another culture in which we would come as a guest. Now, do you want to start with some questions here? I think I'd rather...
I have a question which I think relates to the challenge that you're suggesting, and sort of harkens back to the question that I had yesterday. And it's very specific, but in my mind at least it illustrates this issue. When I was in Taiwan this past fall, almost in every corner, there was some kind of temple, usually a Taoist temple, but very often was Confucian. But anyway, they're very eclectic there, and these things get mixed together. And the government is very tolerant, and so anybody that has a spare space may set up a temple, and then people pay to be able to pray at the temple, have specific needs met, and the operator of the temple makes a nice tax-free income. So, well, because of that, because of looking at the poverty and sort of raking off money from my standpoint, quite legitimate, I was really offended, by this. But on the other hand, it was very much a deep expression of one of the indigenous, and including the Chinese community that moved over, at least in that sense, indigenous cultures. And it would seem to me that, if one were to go and try to preach the gospel there, on the one hand, you would have to, for many reasons, just deplore that. And on the other hand, you would have to respect that. And I just have a real hard time imagining how one can relate what seem to be, from a human perspective, authentic expressions of faith in something other than myself, and what are clearly very exploited pagan practices.
I can't respond directly on the Taiwan thing.
No, I mean, does that illustrate?
Yes, it illustrates I think it illustrates the point. You're dealing when. I guess I'd like to start with this: that religion, including Christianity, doesn't take long to become absolutely demonic. It can become the rip-off. Some of the greatest rip-off artists are the religionists. I really wonder whether that was tax-free in Taiwan, because
it's supposed to be. But,
yeah, they have their ways of hidden taxes, things of that nature. Let us suppose that in that kind of a society, you had an opportunity to live in and among people like that. It would seem to me that the establishment of a church, as we consider it here, ought to be way down in your priority list. I believe the moment you come out and say, here is, I want to bring Jesus Christ to you, this is language now, you are going to be understood as saying, I've got a religion that's better than yours. And you will be judged on A, the validity of your religion, and B, on how little you rip people off. And if you are of the kind of a good moral type that doesn't rip people off and it doesn't cost them too much, you are probably going to gather some people into that. But it's going to be a misunderstanding of what the gospel is. We have had missionaries who have worked among Muslims for many years, and they have had Christian communities there, but because the Muslims are never, in India at least, an exclusive community there, the Christians are Christian people who moved into the community, or ex-Hindus. Very few Muslims. But in their relationship to Muslims, they have not attempted to establish a church. And so I think it's this tremendous sensitivity that you have to have to try to learn, first of all, what it is that makes people respond. And in effect, it means that if a person is going over into a society like that, he ought to say to himself or herself, first of all, I'm there to learn. I'm there to learn what the understanding of these people is in their whole society. And then finally, let us see how that's going to develop into how I can show my witness to Jesus Christ in that context.
Which may be the meeting of some kinds of human needs, and not an attempt to establish immediately.
Correct. It might mean that you are saying, in order to make this clear, I see a tremendous need, and the need is of medical aid. Yeah, Ralph.
Two things. First, when I read Pilhofer's The Guinea German missionary pioneer instructions to evangelists, native evangelists, written in pidgin. Darwin Howell still has a copy that he should get back. He simply said what they should do is to go to the new God, be new to them too, ask the elders to give them a plot of land for subsistence farming, to sit down and find out the story that they had about their tamburan, about their ancestors, and then tell the stories of the Bible, and they were most of the stories, by the way, Genesis. They're about Genesis, that's all in pidgin. Not directly from, translated by, I think, one of the parts of this was translated, but here was more or less his own Bible histories. And that's precisely where the, in a sense, they didn't go out to establish congregations like we do, you know, and buying property and organizing and everything. They simply went and they did not baptize. This was a very controversial thing. The first converts, because the converts, baptizing them would take them out of the orders of creation of their family and the clan. Even some people who were Christians who wanted to be baptized, they would only do that after the local clan chiefs and elders would allow a Christian to live within that tribe and within that clan and not be de race, pulled out of its roots. Then they would allow the baptism. And then the white missionary, in this case he was a German missionary from the Northern Gentiles All Mission Society, would come up and have kind of a catechization. Did they know enough to become Christians? And then I think baptism was reserved for the white missionary. And then they would start going. And what happened, however, it was not, as sometimes people thought in the Guinea venture, a mass sort of thing. It was done individually. But what happened, though, and you can see it in some of the villages in the Guinea, that what had once been the house tamburan, the house of the ancestors, and clearly, was now the church. A place where only those initiates could be and young men and so forth. Now it was where women would be, and they might double as a school. And a real radical reorganization. And those who had been the elders continued as elders. And the missionaries, the German missionaries, had enough sensibilities for what they call the orders of creation to simply say, well, here's an elder who will take care of all the things that have to do with burials. And it wasn't up to the white missionary from the Great Mission Station to decide what customs could be retained and what could not. It was up to the individual. So some things that might seem to be still very pagan still continued. and they were in dispute, but it was up to that individual elder to make that decision. Same thing with marriage, same thing with lending. So that in some way, as far as I know mission history, they profited by all mistakes that they had made in elsewhere, especially in Africa.
And India.
And India too, yeah. So I guess what I'm saying is that I think that in one sense I can understand what you're saying, that you don't go there to found a church, you see that. On the other hand, I see this among students that I have at PLU and so forth, so-called new Christians, who aren't nurtured in a living Christian community, and who are ad hocish talking with Fellowship of Christian Athletes jocks, and they're nice guys, tremendously nice guys. And I'm not saying, but somehow or other, I'd like to see those very same people who have been become new Christians not be sold a bill of goods to, that's where they get it, all this modern media stuff, kind of media Christianity, which is finally will become an illusion because they tell me this. I'd like to see them also not be mistaken and therefore have a Christian community with all of its good and bad. And that's eventually what you have, wouldn't you?
But Ralph, I think here we're talking about two distinctly different cultures. My comment on most of the cultures where anything would come, in the where Christianity might come in a new sense of the word, you have the very opposite of the Christian athletes jock sort of thing, where people think of community as extremely important. And to them, we are saying, here comes Christ, and they are going to ask automatically, how does Christ fit into the community where we are? Well, what you're saying about the students at PLU are people who will say, I don't want community, I want to have my individual relationship to Christ.
Yeah, they stand off against the established church quite a bit, and there's a very great reluctance to take up those talks.
That's right. Now, I think that in most foreign societies, you're going to have people who are going to ask that question immediately. And I agree completely with what has been done there, that baptism, a friend of mine who has worked among some tribal people in India has said that he works on the principle that if he can't baptize almost an entire village, he isn't going to baptize. And he said, I realize that when I come to the point of baptism, I'm going to be baptizing some adults who really know what it's about, and some of the wives who really don't understand the lingua franca of the area, but only the little tribal language. They're practically like infant baptism. But it's only if you bring the whole community together and then let that community become permeated by Christ that it's going to, this thing is going to carry on. And so we've got to have, a completely different thinking. But the emphasis with them is not to establish community, because the community is there. Their emphasis would be the question, where does Christ fit into my community? And the Muslims would be, that's one reason that the individual conversions from Islam are so extremely difficult. One of the greatest things that's happened in the last few years is that whole families, 2-3 whole families have come and been baptized into the Christian community. They're developing their own support.
If I understand you, what you were saying about the in the Muslim areas, the people who give a hearing to Christianity would be the isolated Hindu who has to get into that area. Is that what you're saying?
Well, no, the only thing I was saying is that they do have church services in the area because there are small Christian communities, but that's not their main target. And if a Muslim comes and says, I want to become a Christian, there is a community that will welcome him. However, the main emphasis is to deal with the full Muslim community in such a way that they can understand what Christ means to them, and the way that has to be done frequently is through a hospital, through various things like a way in which you get cottage industries going for women who other than that are incapable of giving that additional support to the family that keeps them above the brink of starvation. Nursery schools for children. But always being very clear, we're not giving this hospital, we're not running a hospital so that we can catch you when you're down or flat on your back and we can pour the gospel into you.
Mm-hmm. There's a tension, though, respecting indigenous culture forms on the one hand, and avoiding, needing, wanting to avoid, I assume, some kind of new syncretism and the spawning of semi-Christian religious groups. Or isn't that a concern? I mean,
it's a concern, but I think it's a tension that we have to live with, never a tension that we can resolve.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Well, you have that in New Guinea. You have the so-called carbocles.
Yeah.
Every mainline church has it automatically seems that you have a resurgence of their original carbocle, because that's the way they understand it. It's not that the missionary taught them that sort of thing, that they're going to get carbocle from the ancestors, but that's just so deep within them. But every once in a while, you'll find the way that I would at least describe to me is that everybody goes off and finally takes care of the cemeteries of all the ancestors. Because that's the very alive sort of thing. Well, the president of the student body at Martin Luther Seminary, it was really surprising. His name is Tsagi. He died in early death. I was reading the German mission reports, and I said, gee, your family must be chiefs. Is that right, Sadi? In the presence of other students from other tribes, he said, I'll tell you about that later. That was sort of privileged information. And so then I said, after a while in the breakout, what about that? He said, that's true. And he expressed it this way. He said, in the village, other people have to ask for things, but our family can take things.
Mm-hmm.
And that was it. And then he went on and said, but I have another name that I got when I was baptized. And I'm sorry, it was something else. So what does that mean? What does it really mean? It means the one who, like Christopher, is a Christ man. And then he also said about this name, Sagi, he said, our ancestors, I'm quite sure that he used the word, the person can still live in a cave down there. Most of the way. Now this is after 85 years, he was directing one of the original places there. So I think you have to run that risk, you see that?
All right, I can give you a very good example of that risk. In Madagascar, they have a custom called Famadiana. After a person dies, and if he's a person of some prominence, I think it's after 5 years, the bones are taken out of the grave, wrapped up in clean clothing, and buried again. And this is an old pagan, if you will, but an old cultural custom. And the Anglican Church in Madagascar has developed a liturgy for it. Now the Anglican Church, I'm not sure if I agree with that, because I wasn't in Madagascar long enough really to evaluate how many of the other, ancestor worship. A lot of people whom you will accuse of ancestor worship, I was in the man who took me, was Malagasy himself. The people of Madagascar are known as Malagasys. The Malagasy man said, you know, when we talk about death and our ancestors, we do not talk in terms of worship. We say that our ancestors have entered into a different kind of a relationship with us, and we want to remember that relationship. That's what we mean by this word, ancestor worship. We are not worshiping them. It reminds me very very much of, I think it's Article 27 of the Augsburg Confession, where they say, on the cult of the saints, we remember the saints as examples to us in our lives. I'd like to turn the conversation in a little different direction, though, and that is, if a person is going to go overseas, I'll start with overseas, and I think it's just as true if you're dealing with people in a different cultural context over here, which may be your next door neighbor who doesn't think the way you do. But it can become very classic overseas. First of all, I think we have to shed a bunch of American presuppositions. One of them is that if you go overseas, let's say your wife has been talking about the possibility, you'd go overseas and you'd be offered something in the area of philosophy to teach at a university, and you would ask, well, exactly what do you want me to do? Could you send me a job description? And the answer to that would be, huh? Job description. Yes, and we've had missionaries who came out to India. We had one that stayed for 4 weeks, I think, or 6 weeks, and when he left, well, I think he had to do a little self-justification, but he finally said, the church in India didn't know what they were going to do with me, because he said, well, what do you expect me to do here? And they said, we want you to learn the language first. And you see, that misconception of learning a language, we in America are cursed with monolingualism. And if we're bilingual, we're bilingual within the Anglo-Saxon or Romance languages, which are still within the general culture. But to realize that when you think in terms of another language, people do things so completely differently. And so as an American, going over there, we've got to say, first of all, I've got to understand the culture. No, not first of all. I must make it a priority to get at an understanding of the culture, even if it's no more than to say, I don't understand. A couple examples is that if I would ask you, Ralph, I would ask you, could I meet with you this evening? And you would say, no, I'm going out on an overnight hiking trip. That is a very un-Indian way of saying it. You would say to me, well, it will be very difficult. I will try. And if you don't know me very well, you will say, I will try, but it will be very difficult. You have no intention whatsoever of canceling your hiking overnight hiking trip, but it would be crude to me to say no. You would because I would interpret from your no, listen, Herb, I don't want to talk to you this evening, and the rest of the time we're at Holden, I'm not interested in talking to you either. That's what I would get out of your word no. But if you say it will be very difficult, if I don't ask you any further, then I mean, all right, he means no, but he means maybe later when I come back I'd be glad to talk to you. However, if I say, why is it difficult? And then you say, well, I'm going to be gone. I'm going to be 10 miles away from here. You know, in American language, I say, well, why didn't you just say no? To many people overseas, our blunt no is simply crudity. And yet I have told this to people in the congregation, told this to a lot of Americans, and say, well, Americans who then say, well, they're just a bunch of devious people. They aren't telling you the truth. Of course they're telling you the truth. A colleague of mine, well, this Suvi Seshamuttu, of whom I spoke yesterday, was telling me one time about marriages in India, you know, are arranged for the greater part. And he said, he was fuming mad when he was talking to me. He said, this family over there wanted to have their son marry my sister, and we really didn't like it. And he's not that sort of a boy. We don't really want him as our sister's husband. And so we told them, you live 400 miles away, and that's going to sound good. You live 400 miles away, and that you would like that marriage to happen next in June, And we really don't have the money to host all of you people when you come down, because it's within their cultural understanding that the bride's family hosts the groom's family that comes from such a distance. And he said, you know what they said to us? They said, well, that's all right. We'll pay our own costs here. Didn't they know we meant no? Oh, he was angry. In another time, there was a young man who was had written to his father, and he said, Father, it's time for me to get married. So father investigated certain people, and he made initial inquiries about a young lady whom we knew. And after a while, the father got, Martin Kretzmann knew this man very well, and the father came in. This was all going on in Tamil. He said, well, what does your son say about the marriage? And he handed him the letter. He said, this is what he says about the marriage. And the letter said, in effect, Father, this is a very serious matter, and it is a matter about which we must all pray and give deep consideration to. Your loving son. And Kretzmann looked at it and he said, what does he say? And the father laughed. He says, no. But you see, if he had said no, the word would get around that that girl had been rejected by another person, and her chances of being married to somebody else would go like that. I once had I learned these things the hard way. I had the tactlessness to ask a man whose daughter was being considered as the wife of a young pastor. I said, how are things going in regard to that relationship? Fortunately, only the two of us were together. And he said, sir, that is a question you must never, never, never ask. Because if that relationship doesn't work out, and this one didn't, it will be generally known that my daughter was rejected. Now, the fact of the matter is that everybody knows. This isn't secret, but these things are done in a certain way. And so you don't ask for agendas, and you have to wait for things. This little book, The Silent Language, says that if you go into certain places and you want to meet a man, they will say, would you wait for a while? That man will be in there drinking his morning tea, not doing a blessed thing. But depending upon your status in the community and his status, he will let you cool your heels for a half hour, an hour, 2 hours, or whatever it might be. But for you to be ushered in immediately, it's just not done. Now, we Americans say, but my goodness, I've still got to do all this sort of thing, and I'm supposed to waste my time sitting here warming my heels, and because he's there and he's not doing anything else, why doesn't he allow me in immediately? It isn't done. You mean to tell me you are treating this man the way you would an ordinary servant, that you say, boy, gin and tonic, please, that sort of thing? He's not going to be treated that way. That's the sort of thing you are doing. And you've got to realize that when you get overseas, a lot of people are going to test you that way. Last year, Dorothy was tutoring a black... The first one was a black man, wasn't it? And this man came for a couple tutoring sessions, and then he missed two or three times, and you went there and he just didn't show up. And so we talked to, some of you know Will Hertzfeldt, he's going to be on the staff here, but no, it was Al Perot, a black pastor of the church. Was it with him or did we talk to that, somebody else, two black people. And we said, what does this mean? We at least knew that, you know, the first reaction is, well, you know, the caricature. Those black people, they're not responsible, they don't come. We asked, what does this mean? Because we knew there could be another message. And the man said, well, we're not sure what it means. It could be that he's irresponsible and isn't coming. On the other hand, it could be a way of finding out whether Dorothy really means it or not. Whether she's just another one of these do-gooders that says, well, I'm willing to tutor this poor black person and all that sort of stuff, not treating him as a person, or whether there was a real concern, it would be the concern that would be willing to come there two or three times and simply turn back because the person wasn't there. Now, it's very easy to say, there are other people who want to be tutored. But to establish that kind of thing, and I think you find it in the Hispanic community, you will find it with the Indian, American Indian community, to be able to let someone else set your agenda.
Herb, I think I'm hearing what you're saying, maybe not all of the aspects of it, but let me ask you this question. There are mission societies, I think of the Northern Middlebelt Mission Society and many others, and they're still in operation, who have met up with these things that you've met up with. To me, they seem to have a wisdom which the denominations that I know were merit getting elected to that committee and a bit of pastoral rivalry, whatever it is, some kind of church politics. But they seem to have set their sights for a long haul, not just for the short haul. They certainly are aware of this and have been aware of this for a long time, haven't they? How do you gauge the sort of play of the Northern Denomination Society, people like that? Would you say they are still attempting to establish church over there, or am I making my point here to you?
The Neuen Dettelsau are the people. Is the Hermannsburg also work in New Guinea?
No.
Okay, well then it's Neuen.
The old Leipzig.
No, it's Neuen Dettelsau. They have that very interesting combination of having mission boards, which have a tremendous. We seem to have the opposite. They have mission boards, which have been, and you notice that you know that in Germany, mission boards are not denominated. It's not quite correct. Mission boards are sort of free mission organizations. They're not connected to a specific denomination. Or if they are, they can have two or three mission boards. The Church of England has the Church Missionary Society, which is broad church. The Society for Propagation of the Gospel is high church. There's a lot of vision that you have there. But then individuals can come along and really... somehow or other, I think we have to talk about the need for an individual to realize this. Because the people whom I met in New Guinea at Finchhofen certainly indicated in a lot of respects some of the most paternalistic stuff as individuals. Sort of the German mentality, so sage geschrieben, this is the way we do it. And I guess that's what I'm pleading. I think the mission board isn't going to do it. Over here, we seem to have, in America, we seem to have the opposite extreme, in that the mission board is so tied to an individual denomination that we in the Missouri Synod, for example, were told that our relationship with other Christians in India ought to be governed by the speed with which the Missouri Synod was establishing relationship with such horrendous bodies as the ALC and the LCA. And we simply listened and proceeded to go on in our own merry way, having joint all pulpit and altar fellowship with the ALC and the LCA up in our mountain, in the place where we were up in Kodaikanal. Or, if we couldn't do it too publicly, smilingly, they would say, well, we understand, we know that that's not where your heart is. Which does bring us back to another thing that the real strength, I believe, of... That mission has got to be ecumenical. And I'd like to suggest that word ecumenical in two meanings. The one that we usually have, ecumenical, meaning interdenominational. But another factor is to have it ecumenical in the sense of the whole world, where we are really beginning to blend different cultures. I would hope that somehow or other people could really probe into a man like Nehemiah, the Indian who is here, and try to find out, ask him, he's unmarried, he'd know all of these things, and to see if you can really find out how he ticks. I think he might really be able to tell you. But you can't ask him, what is different between your culture and our culture? He may be able to say some of these things. But really to sit down there and try to see whether you can see ways in which he operates. Whenever there is a foreign person around here, to see if you can find that out. And then to be able to understand the way people of different cultures operate in their society, and to deal with it with respect.
I guess maybe what I was getting at is I wasn't interested so much in the mission board sending. I was more interested in that the missionaries who are sent do the sort of thing that you were just talking about here, wherein to avoid syncretism, the Anglican Church at least put something in the place of the old rite, as it went out to these people. There's a study by Tippett on Solomon Islands Christianity that compares the Methodist missions, your primitivism in Solomon Islands, and the Anglican. Now the Anglicans come off, and this is from McGovern's Church Growth Institute study, and it's in the World Council Church Study of Missions. The Anglican mission comes off much better, simply because they didn't radically change the borders of community. They kept morning and evening, they kept all kinds of scripture readings, they kept all kinds of festivals, they kept blessing the field, they kept all kinds of things that took the place of what had been there. Whereas the Methodists not only had a stronger Reformation, Protestants or Reformation, but they the backlash was it was very virulent in their section. And there were the same sort of people, little parts of Solomon Islands, and there wasn't a lot of overlap, but the one was simply taken over and devastated, almost like with a forest fire, when the current cult came. And the other one, now I don't know, the current cult isn't in either, you know, there's a lot of Christianity, like you mentioned, the thing in Zaire today. And I'm not giving up on that either. But it would seem to me that just as a matter of churchiness, it seems odd to me to talk that way, because I'm not really that high church, but that somehow the missions that establish individual congregations and altars and places of gathering still have a tremendous effect in the whole cultural relations, even if it's not immediately apparent, even if a lot of it is ununderstandable. I don't think it's magic, you know what I mean?
Okay. Yeah.
You see what I'm getting at?
Yes. Maybe the one thing, since we're getting close to the end of the time, the one thing I think, what are the things, what is the nature of the gospel that we really want to get across? I mean, what are the... and I'd like to suggest this. What are the non-negotiables? The non-negotiable, however we're going to witness to it, is our commitment to Jesus Christ. Now that's obvious. The second non-negotiable, this is that If we believe in our commitment to Jesus Christ, then our conviction that the body of Christ is one is the second non-negotiable. And this is where I part company with McGovern and others who are talking about cultural types of Christianity. I am not, what I am saying is that ultimately the church must be a continuing witness to the fact that in Jesus Christ we are one. And that if we can set up, quote, cultural churches, or permit them to come into being, they must, somehow or other, we must continually bear witness to the fact that this is never the end, be-all and end-all of things. For if we deny the body of Christ, if we deny the body of Christ, we also deny Christ. And this is a terrible indictment upon Lutheranism in the United States, and a terrible indictment upon Missouri Synodism, out of which all my roots come. And to put this in a very theological context, I would say your Christology determines your ecclesiology. The way you see Jesus Christ, God and man together, is the way you will see the church. And I have this respect for the Anglican Church, in spite of its parochialism, that it reaches out always to find a way in which all people can be brought under this umbrella. They've run the risk of syncretism in that Fomadian occult worship. You run a lot of risks. But there's a nice proverb that if there's a well, you will never fall into the well and kill yourself if you never go close to the well. You'll only die of thirst.
Well, I think we may be saying the same thing from a different angle. It would seem to me that we met some really good Anglicans, including a native bishop in New Guinea, who couldn't understand how there could be a church without bishops. He was a little Anglican. Bishop Port Norrisbury, you see at Fellows, they had invited about 80 students from a former Anglican teacher's college that was kind of going broke to come to this Lutheran Fellow teacher's college, and they came together with their priest. And Father Woods is son of the primate of Australia, one of the real council churches, a real fine fellow. So somehow he invited me to one of the meetings of the standing committee of Papua New Guinea, and I went there and I talked with these people. And what was interesting is that they could not imagine, they didn't know what Lutheranism was, but now that this was the first year of their students being on the same campus with these others, they thought that they ought to have some conversation, obviously. And I guess despite the fact that I knew I was coming from altogether opposite, Father Woods and I, theologically and historically and critically, we go on the rounds a lot of times, weeks before. This is the first time I met, and it was a native bishop who said simply, how can you have a church without a bishop? And he really meant that. He meant that right down to the ground. So that your centrality of, say, the gospel, or the centrality of Christ determining ecclesiology, wasn't. In other words, ecclesiology there was pretty well determining Christ, you see.
I would claim that if you go, I don't know, this is a long, we don't want to get into this now, Ralph, but I still would claim that within Anglicanism you've got a real problem on they emphasize the divinity of Christ, and therefore they got hung up in the bishop business. As against the humanity.
I agree with you there, but I just was wondering, you know, they do a tremendous amount of stuff that is there, and from what I could see in the beginning, they were, you know, a lot of things that the big Elkhorn church
tremendously large Lutheran church, wasn't it?
Yeah. And in Church of South India, we have had a lot of this. And I think that the things that are happening, and, you know, you don't solve a problem by having a union. That can blow the whole thing apart. But there are, it still doesn't change the fact that we have to look at this from a viewpoint, ready to walk. I guess what I'm trying to say is that if we're going to be involved in this, we've got to be ready to walk in there stark naked. Of our, if that's at all possible, of a lot of our cultural accretions, and then say, then respond, well, I never thought of it that way. The thing that has always shamed me is that, you know, after 20 years, I used to think, boy, I've really got this down, I really understand it, and all of a sudden I run smack dab into a cultural thing where I've been running roughshod over people for years. In all my stupid ignorance, loving ignorance.
That's
maybe.
Why you insist that if there's new mission work to be done, that the people...
Not if, when.
When. All right. When. Okay, in other words, the if is, the command is still there. It's a matter of...
Unquestionably.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, that's very good. Yeah. All right, but when it's to be done, then the call comes from them.
From them. What do you want? Now, you are a Christian community over there. What do you want us to do? How can we work with you? And while I will admit that you can find places where there are no Lutherans, you can find places where there are no Anglicans or things like this, I don't see that there are, there may be exceptions, but I don't even want to talk about that. The greater part of the third world, you will find a Christian community to which you can relate.